Hello there, and thank you for downloading the Agendas podcast from the 22nd of August. And on the programme today, we reported on all the happenings at the United Nations General Assembly as world leaders focused on the war in Ukraine. And we also found out why Matt Damon and Prince William have been speaking on the outskirts of that event. Meanwhile, as two billionaires give their money to climate action, we discussed whether environmental philanthropy is a new trend. And after a mini tornado was filmed in our lane, we found out whether climate change is making them more likely. That's with the expert Dr. Diana Francis. We also discussed the potential impact of a landmark ruling by the UAE's Ministry of Justice, which apparently means that UAE courts have been given powers to enforce judgments imposed in civil and financial cases in England. Plus, after more than 200 whales were stranded in Tasmania, we found out what could have caused the disaster. And we spoke to a UAE-based adventurer who helped move 8 cheetahs from Namibia to India. World leaders gathering for the United Nations General Assembly in New York have given the Ukrainian president a standing ovation after his speech. The event, of course, traditionally brings together the leaders from 193 countries. Although this year there are 2 notable exceptions, namely President Putin from Russia and President Xi Jinping from China. Now, in his speech, Volodymyr Zelensky called for an international tribunal to punish Russia for war crimes.
The crime was committed against our state borders. The crime was committed against the lives of our people. The crime was committed against the values that make you and me a community of the United Nations. Russia wants war, it's true, but Russia will not be able to stop the course of history. Mankind and the international law are stronger than one terrorist state. Russia will be forced to end this war.
So Russia's war against Ukraine certainly seemed to be the major theme on the second day of this international gathering. I'm joined in the studio now by Andrew Hosey. He's been following yesterday's activities right into the night. Tell me a bit more about what went on in that United Nations General Assembly.
Yes, well, basically, President Putin announced a partial military mobilization in his first televised address to the nation since the invasion of Ukraine. Calling up 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine. These were his words, spoken by a translator.
To protect our motherland, its sovereignty and territorial integrity, to ensure the security of our nation and people at the liberated territories, I consider it's necessary to support the defense ministry's and general staff's proposals to hold partial mobilization in Russia.
Now, of course, off the back of that, it made sure that that Russia and the war in Ukraine were the main focus at the UN General Assembly. But there was also quite a lot of reaction in Russia itself, wasn't there?
Yes, there has been. The announcement seems to have prompted anger and fear in Russia. One-way flights out of the country are selling out, while more than 1,000 people have been arrested at anti-war protests. That's according to the independent protest monitoring group called OVD Info. It says at least 502 people were arrested in Moscow and 524 people in St. Petersburg.
Who else was speaking yesterday at the UN General Assembly?
US President Joe Biden, he was there. He also addressed the global body. During his speech, he rebuked Vladimir Putin, saying his actions should make your blood run cold.
A war chosen by one man, to be very blunt, a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, invaded its neighbor. Attempted to erase a sovereign state from the map. Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. This world should see these outrageous acts for what they are. Putin claims he had to act because Russia was threatened. But no one threatened Russia, and no one other than Russia sought conflict.
Later, President Biden met the new UK Prime Minister Liz Truss on the sidelines of the General Assembly. The two leaders said they would continue to hold Russia accountable and support Ukraine, a sentiment which was echoed in Liz Truss's speech to the Assembly. She said Russia should pay for damage caused by the war in Ukraine.
He's doubling down by sending even more reservists to a terrible fate. He's desperately trying to claim the mantle of democracy for a regime without human rights or freedoms. And he's making yet more bogus claims and saber-rattling threats.
Now, Andrew, in a connected story, taking place many miles away from New York, there's been a prisoner swap negotiated by Saudi Arabia. What's the story there?
Yes, now this has been very unexpected. 10 men detained by Russian-backed forces in Ukraine have been freed, as you said, in a prisoner swap brokered by Saudi Arabia. 5 were British nationals and 3 of them, Aidan Aslan, John Harding and Sean Pinner, were captured while fighting with Ukraine forces. They were amongst those released. This was one of the most significant prisoner swaps of the war so far. Russia has released 215 Ukrainian soldiers, including commanders of the Azov regiment, which defended Mariupol. In exchange, Ukraine handed over 55 Russian soldiers, as well as the pro-Kremlin Ukrainian politician and oligarch Viktor Medvedchuk, who was facing charges of treason. Families of some of the British detainees had feared that they would or had already been killed. And as recently as Tuesday, rumours on social media began circulating that the death sentence they have been facing had been carried out. But in a video recorded from the plane on the way home to the UK, Mr. Aslan said they were now out of the danger zone and on their way homes to their families.
Gundy, Aidan Aslan and Sean Pinner, we just want to let everyone know that we're now out of the danger zone and we're on our way home to our families and whatnot. Not just us, there was also in total 10 foreigners that were in captivity. We're going to be pretty quiet in regards to media stuff until we get things sorted out and whatnot. We just want everyone to know the good news, etc. So thanks to everyone that's been supporting us and whatnot, so it's really much to be appreciated. Like, really.
You can just about catch their words. They're obviously very relieved individuals there heading home. And it does appear that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman engaged personally in the successful mediation sessions to release those 10 prisoners from various countries. The Kingdom's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said in a statement that the move was based on the support of Prince Mohammed and in continuation of his efforts to adopt humanitarian initiatives towards the Russian-Ukrainian crisis. The Saudi prince held successful mediations in releasing prisoners, not just from the UK, but from Morocco, the US, Sweden and Croatia. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs added that the relevant Saudi authorities received and transferred them from Russia to the kingdom and thereafter facilitated procedures for their safe return to their respective countries. While world leaders meet at the United Nations General Assembly, many thousands of NGOs, charities and business people have also gathered in New York to network, raise money and do business. And the spotlight at the UN might be on the war in Ukraine, but one of the major events also taking place on the sidelines is Climate Week NYC, which is an annual opportunity for international leaders from business, government and civil society to get together to showcase global climate action. Philanthropists are also there. For example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is in town. They're planning to lobby the UN about their causes, namely persistent gender inequality and hunger. Now, one expert who has travelled from Dubai to New York is Tofiq Rahim. He's a research fellow at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government. He's also executive director of GlobeSite, which is a consultancy based here that works with leading philanthropic organisations. I spoke to him a bit earlier and he told me why he's in New York.
Definitely UNGA revolves around the countries and governments present, especially the formal events at the UN. But just like a lot of these gatherings now, whether it's Davos, etc., the real activities and conversations happen outside the confines of the UN. And kind of it's a bit of madness in New York this week because almost every hotel is taken over, every venue is taken over. And there's everybody ranging not just from governments, but philanthropists, civil society, media, celebrities, kind of all descending on New York for a range of conversations from everything on climate to food security to oceans to HIV to Ukraine to Russia and beyond.
I mean, that sounds incredibly busy, incredibly chaotic, but also potentially incredibly fruitful. What events specifically have you traveled to attend?
Yeah, there have been a couple actually of particular interest. One is the Global Fund replenishment, which is its seventh replenishment around its 20th anniversary, which is being hosted by President Joe Biden. And the Global Fund is dedicated to combating HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. And it's such an essential need that in some ways, you know, during the COVID pandemic, we forgot about. So we're expecting probably close to $15 billion being mobilized for this effort today. And so that's one that I would particularly highlight. And then there's a couple organized by UNHCR that are of interest, you know, but it seems that, you know, from a few years ago, the issue of refugees and some of the conflicts that have been ongoing have fallen by the wayside as other issues like climate kind of come to the forefront.
Are you expecting any big pronouncements to come out of UNGA, out of the UN General Assembly? I know that at the end of the sort of environmental COP meetings, you often get a legally binding contract or you might get a statement of intent. Are we expecting anything on any points to come out of this meeting?
Well, so at UNGA itself, you'll just have really a series of speeches. There's no real kind of agreement that gets formed. But on some of the side events, there's definitely announcements and pledges. And it's not a mistake that some philanthropists have used this time to make announcements, you know, particularly as, for example, Climate Week is also being held in New York at the same time. And so you're getting more of these side announcements of funding commitments more than you're getting any type of political agreement, et cetera.
Your focus is, of course, philanthropy. We've had two really quite big announcements in the last 7 or 8 days. Two billionaires have announced that they're going to be giving their fortunes away. Specifically, the Lululemon founder has pledged $76 million to save Canada's wilderness. And then, of course, we have the Patagonia founder, Yvon Chouinard, saying that he's going to donate all of his wealth to environmental nonprofit issues. What's interesting is that they seem to be both, instead of trying to solve world poverty or maybe diseases, they seem to be looking to help the environment, which feels like a new twist on philanthropy to me.
I think it's become one of the issues that has become a cause célèbre the last couple of years. And, you know, I think during, again, the COVID pandemic, that definitely was not being seen widely. But people like Mike Bloomberg and Jeff Bezos have made significant commitments and announcements around climate before. So it's not the first time. I think what is significant is the amount and scope of the founder of Patagonia's announcement, as well as the nature of the Lululemon founders kind of on this almost public-private, you know, stewardship of parks, which harkens back to the, you know, Central Park days about 100 years ago.
One of the things that's so interesting about the donation given by Yvon Chouinard is that he's giving away all of his wealth at once. Is that unusual for a billionaire?
It's unusual. And I think the question would be, what is he giving, how, and how will that be managed over time? And so what is unique is that he's, you know, almost made a legal commitment. So not just an announcement that we've normally seen around the size of a part of wealth. And I think that's what, you know, people have skepticism around it. But, you know, I think proof will be in the pudding. People, he's made it publicly. People will be able to see over the next, you know, few years. And if it becomes a model, you could see other companies put their shares into a trust.
Tawfiq Rahim there, a research fellow at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government and executive director of GlobeSight, who are a consultancy based here in Dubai that works with leading philanthropic organisations. And as you can hear there, it was a busy environment. People started rehearsing for a speech behind Tawfiq. So I'm sorry for the noise at the end of that interview. Now, another example of just how big a focus is being placed on climate change solutions at the moment is the Earthshot Prize Innovation Summit, which took place last night. A host of celebrities came together for that event, which is an initiative that was originally launched by His Royal Highness Prince William from the United Kingdom. Now, the Earthshot Prize describes itself as a catalytic global environment challenge, and it aims to encourage climate action by discovering, accelerating, and scaling solutions to repair and regenerate the planet. DP World has been one of the sponsors involved in that prize. And in fact, I think they donated $1 million. I will check that for you. But billionaire Michael Bloomberg opened the event.
There is no challenge bigger than the battle against climate change. Success requires global cooperation and big, bold new ideas. And that's what inspired Prince William to launch the Earth Prize 2 years ago. Now, I know how much he wanted to be here today. I talked to him the day before yesterday. But there is no better way to honor the extraordinary life of his grandmother, Queen Elizabeth, than by gathering here in support of work that he is leading on an issue that meant so much to her. The Earthshot Prize, I think, is a testament to the environmental legacy of Queen Elizabeth. And I know Prince William and King Charles are both determined to extend that legacy. Prince William created this prize to incentivize the kind of innovation that can accelerate the fight against climate change. And our foundation, along with the other Global Alliance founding partners, has been glad to support it from the very beginning.
Meanwhile, His Royal Highness Prince William actually sent a recorded video to the end for the event. For obvious reasons, he wasn't able to attend in person. He's, of course, the founder of that prize, and he told the gathering that the difficulties the world is facing today cannot deflect from dealing with the challenges of the future.
Together in this room are the people and organisations who will help us to achieve the Earthshot mission to repair, restore, and rejuvenate our planet within this current decade. That mission is not simple. I know that the world is an uncertain place right now, that many families and communities across the globe are facing unimaginable challenges, from conflict to energy crisis and food shortages. While addressing these in the short term, we must also remain resolutely focused on tackling the greatest challenges that threaten our tomorrow. Because if we don't, the changing climate will only serve to entrench these immediate challenges into fundamental global issues.
So DP World is indeed one of the founding partners of that Earthshot Prize. Sultan Ahmed bin Sulayman, the group chairman and CEO of DP World, announced that the company will invest £1 million to support the work of two Earthshot Prize finalists. They were namely Coral Vita from the Bahamas and also Australia's Living Walls. DP World, together with Expo 2020 Dubai, became a Global Alliance founding partner of the Earthshot Prize about a year ago. Now, Matt Damon, the actor and also activist and co-founder of Water.org, also spoke at that event last night. He urged the continued backing of organisations and innovators who are working to create breakthrough solutions to help the world. He said that he and his partners have been constantly inspired by people they've met ever since they founded the charity that they run, Water.org.
Together, we've had the chance to work with and learn from some remarkable people, mainly women, who are working hard every day to transform the lives of their families. Now, these incredibly resilient people have a lot to teach us about what Benjamin Franklin called the worth of water. It's been a huge privilege for Gary and for me to learn from them and to apply what we learn. And that's one big reason why the Water.org model has been able to reach so many people. It'll be 50 million people that we reach by the end of this month with access to clean water and sanitation. So I've seen firsthand the potential that a breakthrough idea can hold. And if we start seeing more of these transformative solutions across all the challenges facing our planet, then suddenly our Earthshot won't seem so improbable.
Matt Damon there describing his charity Water.org, which is a non-profit organisation that helps people in poverty get access to safe water and improved sanitation through affordable financing. Interesting to hear about what's going on there on the outskirts of the United Nations General Assembly. Certainly there seems to be a big focus on creating climate solutions. We will, of course, be covering that in more detail on the programme as the week goes on. And, of course, as we approach that big United Nations meeting that will be taking place right here in the UAE at Expo City next November. Now, Stormy conditions have once again hit eastern parts of the UAE, and video footage has captured the extraordinary sight of a mini tornado swooping across the landscape near Al Ain. Now, the unusual twister was captured and posted on social media as the area experienced a second day of heavy rain and strong winds. But how common are these events in the UAE, and are they connected to climate change? Joining me now to answer those questions and more is climate expert Dr. Diana Francis. She's also head of the Environmental and Geophysical Sciences Lab at Khalifa University. Dr. Francis, how are you?
Good morning, Georgia. How are you?
Very well indeed. And it's lovely to speak to you. There's nothing I like more than cinematic weather. And the video that we've seen definitely seems to show a tornado to me. Is it a tornado to you, the expert?
Yes, it's a tornado. However, the size is not as the usual tornado we are used to, especially in the United States. So we can call it a mini tornado.
And so what is the difference, for example, between a dust devil and a tornado?
Yeah, so tornadoes involve humidity and rainfall, whereas dust devils are only very dry air, very warm air over desert regions that can rotate as tornadoes. But there is no rain and there is no humidity in this air masses.
I mean, are they frequently occurring here in the UAE? Do you often get tornadoes? Is it just that people haven't been able to film them in the past?
I think it's very rare. It's very rare. And the one we've seen this week is very exceptional as well. Whereas dust devils are very common. We can see them when we are driving, sometimes in the afternoon, especially when the sun heats the surface during the day.
So how come they're so rare? Is it just that the atmospheric conditions required to create a tornado don't exist here in the UAE?
Yeah, so to have a tornado, we need to have a collision between a cold air mass and warm air mass in the upper level of the atmosphere. Okay, tornadoes are born in thunderstorms, and they are born in high, in upper levels, not near the ground. Once the collision between the air, cold air mass and warm air mass happens, the air masses start to rotate. Why? Because of the instability in the upper level. And then this rotation will finally go down, descend from the thunderstorm and to the ground. So tornadoes will form first in the upper levels, and then they will reach the ground. And this, we call it the touchdown of tornadoes.
And of course, in the States, we've seen videos of just how destructive that can be. I mean, with the climate changing here in the United Arab Emirates, or it feels like it's changing, I suppose we haven't quite had enough time to pin that down. But do you think we're more likely to see tornadoes like this? Do you think the weather conditions would change enough to elicit them?
Yeah. So to understand that, we need to put this tornadoes happen events into the larger scale changes. So tornadoes actually they follow the jet stream flow. The jet stream are a ribbon of strong winds in the upper level of the atmosphere, and this jet stream will guide the tornadoes. It's their driver. So there are several studies that have been showing changes in the subtropical jet, which is the jet that is our over our region that is happening. So this could be related to that. But as you said, we still need more years and more data to be sure that this is really linked to global climate change, or it's only, you know, an isolated event.
Thank you so much for your insights on that. Very interesting and very exciting, because it wasn't destructive, very exciting to see a tornado right here in Al Ain. Dr. Diana Francis, head of the Environmental and Geophysical Sciences Lab at Khalifa University. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. A landmark ruling by the UAE's Ministry of Justice means that Emirati courts have been given powers to enforce judgments that have been imposed in civil and financial cases in England. It means that relevant legal action can be taken, and according to the resolution, to impose rulings that have been made in the English courts. The decision followed on from an English High Court order, which was made a couple of years ago, that upheld a Dubai court judgment in a case involving a British citizen over a bounced check. Now, to provide more insight and add detail to what all this means, earlier I spoke to the head of dispute resolution at Dentons Middle East, Andrew Chung, and I asked him what exactly has changed.
It has and it hasn't. Right. So on the one hand, this circular from the Ministry of Justice is non-binding to the court. So I think that's really important. The Dubai court and the chairman of the Dubai court is currently considering this at the moment, deciding what it means and indeed whether the principle of reciprocity actually applies as a result of the Lenkor case. So no, not yet, but it's definitely a positive step forward because proving the principle of reciprocity, and that basically just means that under Dubai law or the UAE law, If a judgment in any foreign court just applied as a matter of administrative process, a Dubai judgment, and enforced it, then the UAE courts, the Dubai courts, would do exactly the same. So that's the principle of reciprocity. And this ordinarily needed to be proved, and it was quite challenging to prove before the Dubai courts and the English courts. But as a result of this recent decision in the UK, the Ministry of Justice has said, we think that the principle of reciprocity has been met in the UK, and so has sort of suggested very politely that the Dubai courts consider that it's met as well, but they're under no obligation to consider that it's been met.
And so what type of rulings are we talking about here? Is it civil? Is it divorces? Is it business cases? Who's it going to affect?
So this is all civil. And so business, divorce cases, these all come under the headings of civil. It's either civil or criminal. So in this case, it will be all civil judgments. The benefit of reciprocity under Article 85 is that judgments are recognised very quickly, within 3 days. However, there is still a need under both English common law principles, which the UAE court judgment has been enforced, as well as UAE principles, that a number of conditions are met. And in the case of both the UK and the UAE, there are these public order or public policy considerations. And so for a divorce case, you know, most famously and controversially, the courts will consider whether the divorce award in the UK is consistent with and doesn't offend public policy in the UAE, which means Sharia principles. So there is still some fairly big caveats to being able to automatically enforce and recognise a judgment. There are others like illegality. There are others like penalty conflicts, which are all part of the common law principles discussed in the Lenkor case on which this communique is based.
So does it essentially mean that if I had a business and I sued someone in the English courts and they ruled that this person who was living in Dubai should pay me back, in the past, that person would not have had to pay me back because he's still resident in Dubai, and now he potentially will have to?
Well, in the past, he will, or actually as of right now, you would have to go to the Dubai courts with your judgment and convince them to enforce that judgment. And that process was not always straightforward because the first thing you'd have to do is demonstrate the principle of reciprocity under Article 85 or just basically retry the matter to seek enforcement, which is quite tricky and high risk. So that remains the position now, notwithstanding this notice from the Ministry of Justice, which is really important to remember. So you could always do that. It's just a little bit more complicated and a little bit more risky. Now, if the Dubai courts are to accept what the Ministry of Justice has said, that the principle of reciprocity had been met, then that process becomes much quicker and easier. It's a three-day administrative process by which it's recognised. However, the defendant, the person who owes you the money, could still argue that it's illegal, that the court didn't have jurisdiction to consider the matter, that they weren't properly served, or indeed that it offends public order for some reason, as they did in the Lenkor case in the UK. And so there's still the opportunity for defendants to be a bit mischievous and try and avoid the enforcement of a foreign judgment. But the process is potentially a bit easier.
Would you expect the floodgates to open, so to speak? Would you expect going forward a huge number of people coming to the Dubai courts and saying, look, I had this judgment in the UK, are you going to recognise it in a 3-day process? Or, do you think the Dubai courts are going to be tested against this new proclamation from the Ministry of Justice?
Look, I think absolutely they will be tested. This has generated a lot of interest, a lot of chat in the legal community, because we think, okay, this could make things a lot easier. Will it open the floodgates? I don't think so. I think if you have a judgment now in the UK and there are assets in the UAE, like a lovely villa on the Palm or something, then you're going to go and enforce, irrespective. You'll try your luck. It's just going to be a bit more expensive and a bit more risky. If Article 85 of the executive regulations implementing the civil procedure rules, which is the name of the relevant precedent here, if that applies, then that just becomes a lot quicker. So maybe we might see people who have got smaller judgments or are going to enforce against lower value assets thinking, well, actually, it might be worth a go now because this could be a much easier, quicker and therefore cheaper process to enforce. But I think if anyone finds assets in the UAE and they have a foreign judgment, they're going to have a go at enforcement.
Why do you think the MOJ, the Ministry of Justice, have introduced this announcement? Is it part of a sort of general theme of streamlining the legal system between the UAE and other European or other world nations?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely part of a trend for the UAE to extend and deepen bilateral relationships with other countries and important strategic trading partners. There are a number of bilateral treaties already that the UAE have entered into on the enforceability of judgments. So most recently, and I think probably most importantly, is the one with India, because that really opened the floodgates to enforcing judgments in India. But there is a UK trade treaty between the UAE and the UK, but it doesn't touch on this issue. So I think this is an attempt by the Ministry of Justice to sort of just bridge and extend that trade treaty into another important area of bilateral cooperation. But as I said, it's still non-binding. And if they really want it to be binding, then they'll need to implement either a treaty which governs that issue or some legislation, basically amend Article 85 or introduce a new article to make it clearer that this applies.
Andrew Chung there, who is Head of Dispute Resolution at Dentons Middle East, giving us a little bit of clarification on that landmark ruling by the UAE's Ministry of Justice. Now, nearly 200 stranded pilot whales have unfortunately died on Tasmania's west coast as rescue efforts continue for around 35 animals. We've been following this story right here in the ARN News Centre, and producer Andrew Hosey joins me in the studio now to talk us through what you've discovered.
Right, a pod of about 230 pilot whales became stranded on yesterday, on Ocean Beach. This is west of Strahan on Tasmania, as you mentioned. Some were also stranded on a sand flat inside Macquarie Harbour, south of the town. As you said, many died overnight. Only 35 now remain. They've survived on Ocean Beach, and rescue and release efforts are continuing. Marine conservationists launched the rescue mission yesterday, but the incident controller, Brendan Clark, said, tragically, most of the mammals on the beach had died. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Karen Stockin. She's an expert on whale and dolphin strandings at Massey University in New Zealand. And I asked her if they know why these strandings happen.
Unfortunately, there's no one size fits all. There's lots of different types of strandings. You have single strandings, you have mass strandings, and then you have unusual mortality events. In this event, we're dealing with pilot whales in an area that's well known for pilot whale stranding. So this is not an unusual mortality event. This is a species that we know has a high propensity to strand at this time of year in this part of the world. So this is definitely a mass stranding. And in that context, there are many things which can cause a mass stranding. We do know that they date right the way back to the years of Aristotle. So these are not necessarily, as most public would often jump to the conclusion, of human induced. They can be actually naturally induced. We also are mindful of the fact that even in natural causes, there are many things that can contribute to a mass stranding. So, for example, if you happen to have a sick or debilitated individual, the chances are the social biology, the high social bonds that these particular species form, the pilot whale, will mean if one animal comes in sick, there's a high propensity for the others to also join them. So here you've got two factors, one of illness and one of a social biology that explains that when you put them together can lead to obviously quite devastating effects, as we're seeing in Tasmania at the moment. There are, of course, human sometimes effects too. But as I say, they're usually linked to unusual mortality events. So when it's a species that's not recognized as being typically close to shore or typically using those particular waters or basically out of season. So they're usually where we have more concerns about human impacts.
Do we find that there seems to be geographical hotspots where these strandings can happen? I mean, just seeing that this is actually the second stranding that's occurred in the area over the last few days.
Yes, Tasmania is one of those spots. If you think about it on a global scale, you've got places such as Cape Cod, Massachusetts in the States, Golden Bay, Farewell Spit, New Zealand, and Tasmania, basically in Australia. There are three of the most notorious hotspots when it comes to mass strandings of pilot whales, as well as in some cases for Massachusetts, common dolphins as well.
When a mass stranding does occur, what's the timeline for a rescue attempt to be made? How long do the whales have to survive?
It really depends on the local conditions. If you think about a country in the peak of summer and in some of the very hot, arid countries, then the reality of it is that time is against the animals that are alive at that stage. There is an awful lot of potential blistering, a lot of induced stress, not to mention overheating, organ compression, etc. Lots of things that are not in favor for the animals. So ideally, the cooler the environment and the cooler times of year, the better, basically, because you've got less chances then basically of having some of those knock-on secondary effects. So there's no specific time per se. It just depends on those local conditions.
Now, if we're not sure what causes these strandings, I mean, I'm guessing it's difficult to try and work out if there's anything that we can do to try and prevent these happening in the future.
I don't think realistically there is the option per se. As I mentioned, these are in the case of New Zealand, we have our records dating right the way back to the 1800s. And of course, in modern legend, in oral histories, these, as I say, are dated right the way back to Aristotle. But with regards to prevention, that's a really tricky thing, because as I mentioned before, there is not one per se cause of why these animals strand. So trying to prevent something when there's multiple different factors that can contribute is incredibly difficult. What we can do, though, is address how we respond to them. And in fact, that's a big part of some of the research that myself and colleagues at Massey University have done over recent years, is looking at how we go about assessing welfare and survival and understanding which are the viable animals that we can ethically, from a welfare standpoint, save and rescue and intervene with, and which are the ones that frankly maybe can't be saved, and for those very reasons possibly have to be obviously cared for in a more palliative way.
It's interesting you bring up the ethical point there, often that this is a natural event and we should just stand back and let it happen. With regards to this mass stranding now, as we said, there's 200 or so have died. Another 30 or so, 35 or so are still surviving. What's going on now with the attempt to rescue them?
Those animals at this point will be undergoing first aid care. So basically keeping them cool, keeping them protected from the sun, getting them to a point where we're trying to alleviate pressures on the organs. So basically removing some of the sand from underneath the body, trying to equalize the animals and basically keeping them cool and calm and ideally as low stressed as possible, because stress in itself is actually one of the major causes of the animals actually dying, of course. So those will be the priorities until the tidal and environmental conditions are correct and at a point where the animals can hopefully be safely refloated.
We'll follow this with interest over the next few hours. Professor Karen Stockin, expert on whale and dolphin strandings at Massey University. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have another conservation story now, because a group of endangered cheetahs have been flown from Namibia to India thanks to a UAE-based aviation company. The Cheetah Conservation Fund has been working for more than 13 years to reintroduce the animals into India after the species vanished from the country over 70 years ago due to overhunting. The company involved in the airlift of the animals was Action Aviation, who are based here in Dubai, and the chairman is Hamish Harding. He joins me now now in the studio to tell me more about it. And you might remember Hamish because he's been on the programme before talking about his extraordinary adventures, which include, and get this, a trip to space on a Blue Origin rocket and a trip down to the depths of the ocean in a submarine to explore the Challenger Deep, which is, of course, the deepest section of the Mariana Trench. And for your latest adventure, Hamish, you are here in the Dubai Eye studio. Welcome. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you, Jordan.
It's lovely to have you in the studio again. You've been a busy bee just lately. I want to talk to you about this project, which sounds absolutely fascinating. But the last time we spoke to you was because you were just about to go down and look at the Titanic. But of course, that sadly didn't happen in the end, did it?
No, it went slightly wrong, actually, just before we went down. I was just about to leave the UAE to head over to the Boston area. And unfortunately, the sub did a first dive down to the Titanic. And when it came up to the surface, there was thick fog all over the sea. And the sub couldn't be recovered on the ship because the most dangerous thing in a sub is smashing into something on the surface and sinking if you lose your flotation. And that's the only thing that can really go wrong, actually. Unfortunately, it couldn't be recovered by the ship. So they moored to a mooring point on the surface to wait overnight. And during that time, the sub got damaged by rough seas and it had to go into port to be repaired. And by the time it was repaired, ready to go down again, I was actually on the next adventure, which was Kilimanjaro with about 20 people from here in Dubai and around the world. We all went up Kilimanjaro just after that.
Wow. Okay. So this is the problem with having back-to-back adventures is that sometimes the technicals go wrong. And so are you still going to be able to go down to the Titanic though?
Yes, the plan is to go next summer. That there's another rescheduled submission down to the Titanic next summer. So I will get to see the Titanic just a year late.
Okay, well, that's fine. And we'll also be sure to get you in the studio ahead of that because we want to find out more. But tell me a little bit more about this project with the Cheetah Conservation Fund, because I know that you've been working alongside the Explorers Club to help repopulate India with cheetahs. How did you get involved with this project in the first place?
It was very much an Explorers Club thing. I'm the chairman of the Explorers Club chapter in the Middle East, and a colleague of mine in Namibia, a friend, Laurie Marker, who has dedicated her life to cheetahs, she is the founder and runs the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia, has saved hundreds of cheetahs, just created a population out of a problem. And she called me up asking, how does she get cheetahs to India? It's not as simple as it looks. They don't do well on Emirates First Class or anything.
They don't like planes.
No,
cheetahs don't like planes.
Emirates won't board cheetahs, sadly.
This is very disappointing. I will have to have a word with a friend that I have who works in Sky Cargo.
Exactly. It's the main thing is that you can't put them in cargo because you need vets all around them and sort of. So you need an aircraft with seats and with
space
for a lot of cages. And you've got to get access to the cages all around at both ends. So in the end, luckily, I had a friend here who had a Boeing 747. This is Roman, who has the company Aqualine. So I borrowed his 747 and they did a great job of providing that aircraft. And we flew down to Namibia just about 10 days ago. And we collected 8 cheetahs from the Cheetah Conservation Fund, flew them direct. It has to be direct. You don't want to do a fuel stop with cheetahs on board because just in case the aircraft had a problem, you can't put them up halfway in the airport Marriott as you on the way to India. So anyway, we got into India and the Prime Minister of India met us, Narendra Modi. He was thrilled to finally get that project going. It's been going a long time in India as a concept to repopulate cheetahs. Finally, it's been done on his birthday, in fact. So he was...
cheetahs for your birthday, I tell you.
Yeah.
What do you get a world leader? There you go.
Exactly.
There's your answer.
For the person who has everything, 8 cheetahs, yes.
8? You transported 8 on the plane.
Yes, there were 3. The idea is it was 3 males and 5 females, and they are now repopulating cheetahs, we hope, into India gradually. It'll take a long time. This is not overnight. And there'll be more coming. This is not the only cheetahs. This is just the initial tranche of cheetahs. And they
a tranche of cheetahs. There needs to, that's a phrase that needs to be used more often. Did you go on the flight yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't miss a thing like that.
Oh, that is... Okay, so you can tell me. So, I mean, how big is a cheetah? How big is a cage? Were they awake or asleep?
They were tranquilized. The cage is about a meter wide, a meter high, about 2 meters long. And we were able to move them in through the passenger doors. We didn't need a cargo aircraft. It was actually just small enough to fit through the passenger doors of a 747-400.
But you had to do the measurements, though. I hadn't quite realised the technicals behind it.
Yes, we actually took out all the economy seats. This is a normal passenger aircraft with first, business and economy. All the economy seats were taken out so that we could fit eight cages down the middle of the cabin through two of the zones. And the rest of the zones were taken up with spare parts because it was such a crucial mission. The two countries involved, Prime Minister waiting for you, you really can't mess up. And so there were spare parts. The thing that can go wrong on an aircraft is somehow you blow a tire or something and there are no spare tires in the middle of Namibia, say. So we had a complete set of spare tires in the further back sections of economy, a full set of wheels for 747, a lot of other spares, so that whatever happens, we'd be able to launch the mission on time.
Goodness. And then how about the cheetahs themselves? Did they sort of wake up at all? Or are they, when you say tranquilized, are they basically asleep?
Not completely. They're just calmed down. The idea, you don't want to be asleep because you're about to be released by the Prime Minister of India. You've actually got to show some real. Yes, you've got to jump around like a cheetah. Otherwise, if you just sort of wander out of the cage and fall over, it's not very cool.
Well, you might get eaten by somebody else, I suppose.
They're super high protection at the moment to make sure they're introduced successfully. So they probably have similar levels of protection to the Prime Minister at the moment. Make sure no sort of angry leopard turns up and doesn't treat them right.
Has breakfast. Yeah. Were you allowed to go anywhere near said cheetahs? Could you stroke a tail through the barrier?
Not really. We were able to watch as the vets opened up cages and made sure they were okay. They were monitoring throughout the flight and giving them sort of water and that sort of thing. So they're awake, but they're just calmed down a bit because they're not as used to flying around the world as we are.
And how long is the journey from Namibia to India?
It was a 10-hour direct flight. The 747's great aircraft, it can fly up to 18 hours direct. And so we had complete direct capability from Namibia into Gwalior Air Force Base. At the last minute, it was going to be Jaipur, but then it changed into Gwalior at the last minute. And Gwalior is an Indian Air Force Base I'd never actually heard of before. But the Prime Minister office then changed it to Gwalior because we had better helicopter connections. And the cheetahs get VIP treatment, of course, and we tag along. So the Indian Air Force laid on three helicopters. We went in a Chinook from the Indian Air Force with all the vets. And then the cheetahs, four of them went into each MI-17. There were two MI-17 helicopters. So we moved straight from Gwalior Air Force Base with a short half an hour flight into Kuno National Park in Madhya Pradesh, which is the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, literally the middle of nowhere.
Not unreasonably. Cheetahs don't do well in the suburbs of Delhi.
So, that is absolutely true. We're going to pick up the story again in just a few minutes' time because I just need to quickly do a quick break. But we're going to keep Hamish with us. We're going to continue the story of exactly how these cheetahs were released and where they were released and what happened, whether they just indeed bounded off into the future, into their future lives. And we're also going to find out what Hamish is getting up to next. We are in the middle of a conversation, a conservation conversation. Can I say that? Because a group of endangered cheetahs have been flown from Namibia to India. That's thanks to a UAE-based aviation company. The chairman of that company is Hamish Harding. He's stayed with me in the studio to tell me all about this trip. It's absolutely fascinating to find out how it's all been sort of orchestrated. And Hamish has had a busy time over the last few weeks, haven't you? You've just been sort of added to the living legends of aviation. You were given that award by Morgan Freeman in Austria a few weeks ago, is that right?
Yes, I was extremely honoured to be inducted into Living Legends of Aviation, which is an amazing organisation with some of the most famous names in the world in aviation. So I was amazingly honoured and slightly surprised originally to
To be added. Well, I've looked through the list. It's got everyone from Buzz Aldrin to Jeff Bezos. Is it Jeff Bezos? Elon Musk? John Travolta. To be added to a list alongside John Travolta sounds very cool indeed. And now tell me about this trip that you were involved in. Of course, it was organised in part by the Explorers Club, which is an international organisation dedicated to the advancement of field exploration and scientific inquiry. And you can understand why that organisation would focus on a conservation project such as this. And you flew eight cheetahs from Namibia to India, where they were released on the Prime Minister's birthday, Narendra Modi. And we basically followed your story right up until the point where the cheetahs were now on a helicopter. So what happened next?
Well, this is an incredibly important project because the cheetah's been extinct in India since independence, 1947. So it's 75 years now that there's been no cheetahs in India. And it's such an important project to get cheetahs back into India, get them breeding, get a serious population of cheetahs again. And so the Prime Minister's been pushing that. Many people have been wanting that, but it needed Narendra Modi's personal sort of push to make these things happen in the end. So we're on board this MI-17s for the cheetahs, Chinook helicopter of the Indian Air Force for us. And we landed in this national park, Kuno National Park, which is about 6 hours drive south of Delhi, or probably 9 hours on
I'm looking it up now. Yes, Kuno National Park looks beautiful.
So it's a beautiful place. It's a proper jungle kind of habitat for cheetahs. It's ideal for cheetahs. And they're now being looked after. They're inducted gradually into the park to make sure they're okay. They're the super VIPs of the park at the moment.
Because I imagine, do you know whether the cheetahs were raised in the wild or were they were raised in the wild, not in captivity?
Yes, they're very much wild cheetahs. There are cheetahs that are much more domesticated and sort of, well, not domesticated exactly, but not unfamiliar with human beings. But these ones are genuinely the wild cheetahs because they've got a hunt. At the moment, they're being given buffalo meat in a very sort of, Uber Eats type of way. It's delivered to their pen and they just
live
eat.
Or dead?
Dead
buffalo.
Buffalo meat is provided dead to them, but they will have to then start hunting. Typically, they like their gazelles and that kind of thing. So they'll eventually get back into hunting. These are proper cheetahs that do hunt for their food back in Namibia. And so they are the wilder versions. They need to be scared of human beings to some extent. We don't want them getting near people. People are the biggest threat to these animals in India now. So the local villagers are all being educated not to do anything bad for the cheetahs and get used to them.
Gosh, how interesting. I mean, absolutely fascinating. And I really appreciate you coming into the studio to tell us all about it. Hamish Harding, he is the chairman of Action Aviation. He's a member of the Explorers Club here in the UAE. And of course, now one of the living legends of aviation, which is a pretty cool list of titles. Hopefully we will catch up with you again in the near future when you come and tell us about another one of your adventures that you've got planned in the near future. But in the meantime, thank you so much indeed for your time.
Thank you very much.